Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 40, Unpacking Petunia, another of our miniature episodes with bonus content. Today we will be talking with Emma Nicholson about the many layers of Petunia Dursley. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. My co-host today is Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing and author of several Harry Potter essays. Thanks, Emily, for meeting up virtually with me again for this bonus conversation.
It is just a thrill, as always. And especially to talk about Petunia. I've just been editing some of my own writing that talks about Petunia and her parenting. So this is fresh in my mind.
Oh, very good. Yes. Well, we have to think about parent Petunia as well as child Petunia as we're talking today. And leading us in that conversation is Emma Nicholson, whose name you might recognize from our closing because she is our podcast technical editor. Thanks so much, Emma, for joining us in the front of the house, so to speak.
Thanks, Katie. It's an honor to be on the other side of the microphone, as it were, with my, as I've said previously, horrible accent and lack of expertise. But nonetheless, I'm really looking forward to today, and I'm hoping we're going to get some really great discussion out of it. Not looking forward to editing it later and listening to the sound of my own voice, but we'll see how that goes.
Well, you always do such a great job for us and always have so many wonderful ideas. I always look forward to hearing about your thoughts about the episodes afterwards, too. And you have written a piece that you have put up on Archive of Our Own, AO3, that's called Real Life at Number 4, Examining Petunia Dursley's Timeline. Emma, what made you take a second look at Lily Evans's sister, Aunt Petunia?
Well, funnily enough, it started with Dumbledore. I've got, coming from a business background, I've got a habit of trying to put incidents or episodes that might happen with clients or with staff into a timeline. And it's a very good technique to kind of look at the facts away from the emotion and kind of get a bit of clarity on the events. So putting events into order. And J.K. Rowling's really good at hiding the order of events through her book. And for me, it was useful in understanding Dumbledore in relation to what he knew about Horcruxes and how that affected how he interacted with Harry. And during that, I couldn't help but focus on how he left Harry in Petunia's care. And it made me start to think about what Petunia herself had been through, because she's quite interesting in the fact that we don't find out about a lot of her past until the very end of Harry's story. So by rearranging everything that happens to her into a linear order, we can go back and know what she knew at the time and how that might affect how she interacts with Harry.
Yeah, one of the things I really like is that this is one of those characters who you don't really understand until you do some rereading, you know, because as you say, so much about Petunia is revealed at the end. But then if you go back and reread with the idea, oh, there is this, you know, part of Petunia that we hadn't really thought about before, it does help you to come to new insights.
Yeah, that's JK's secret, isn't it? To make a book that's just so lent towards rereading and rediscovering all these little secrets that are throughout it. Because sometimes it's in the tiniest piece of dialogue, you know, something you've kind of read casually 100 times over, and you know, it might be the 50th time you've picked up the book and you go, hang on, maybe that means a little something. And her books are so great at giving us this depth of stuff to sort of dig into over and over again.
Yeah, and I do think Petunia is a multi-layered character. You know, we can actually kind of try to figure out her psychology a little bit. And one of the things that you came away with that I think is so interesting, Emma, is you have some sympathy for Petunia. Where does your sympathy come from?
I do. And I think perhaps it's the age to which I came to Harry Potter. I was an adult when I discovered the books. And I guess that sort of lends your own life experience and other sort of context when you sort of view the character. And the more I thought about Petunia from a real life aspect of how she might react to situations as a parent, as an adult, I did start to feel that sympathy for her, because we'd sort of touched on in one episode about humour, bullying and how it relates in the wizarding world and what it means to have magical power and to be a muggle and to, you know, to be in positions of powerlessness. And the Dursleys, being a muggle family, are certainly in that position of powerlessness. And I think that's one of the things that really spurred me on to have a bit of sympathy with her, is that when you, from her perspective of having absolutely zero power and often zero control in the events that are befalling her, that starts to give you a bit of an empathy for her.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is interesting that we learn is, of course, that she had communicated with Dumbledore about going to Hogwarts. And so you get this sense that, you know, she actually, as a child, you know, and you talk a bit about this in your piece, that, you know, she probably saw Lily performing magic, and then she gets the, you know, probably accidentally in her childhood, like Harry does. And then when she gets the Hogwarts letter and so on, and that Petunia is understandably wanting to be a part of that world as well, and that there was some kind of communication with Dumbledore about that, that left Petunia on the outside, and as you say, really not in a position of being in control or being able to get something that she had really wanted, which was access to Hogwarts or to the magical world.
Absolutely. Not only that, but she had a pretty poor representation of the wizarding world in Snape as well. When we first see Snape and Lily meet, he talks about wouldn't spy on you anyway because you're a muggle. And even though Petunia doesn't know what that word means, she can't help but miss the context. He drops a branch later on her, and I can't help but think what else he said about his muggle father, who he didn't particularly get along with. And if you think about Lily and Snape's friendship, it's likely that they spent a fair amount of time together, perhaps in the school holidays and probably around the Evans house, because, you know, as you said, they found the letter together. So he's obviously around Petunia, and I don't think that she could help miss some of the, what I'd consider very thinly veiled sort of anti-muggle sentiment that he's kind of got boiling under there. And it doesn't make for a great impression, I think, as a child. And you've got to factor in the fact that, in a way, Petunia is losing her sister. You know, she's losing her to the wizarding world, which she desperately wants to be a part of. And it's a cultural and physical separation between the two sisters.
And we see, you know, that I was thinking about that as well. I think that's really significant, because I have a sister who I'm close in age with, and we were thick as thieves growing up. I mean, there was no separating us. And if somebody had come in and sort of whisked her off, that would have been deeply painful for me. And so I think that's a really interesting point, that, you know, she was really losing a sister there.
And for all intents and purposes, to a world which is quite dark and dangerous in the long run, as much as we'd like to say, well, let's absolve the wizarding world and have good sentiment about it because our sister's there. I mean, you've got Snape as an example, and then they later on get embroiled in a wizarding war where wizards kill wizards. This is a very dark and gruesome world that Lily's gotten herself involved in. She's in the middle of a war, and, you know, it really has taken her sister, and it ends up taking her sister in the most real and mortal sense of the word.
Yeah, I think that's such a powerful idea. And I think that this really highlights the muggle-wizard divide. Petunia is really at the center of that. She's one of these people, like Arabella Figg, who knows about the wizarding world, but she's on a little bit on the outside of it. She's on the boundaries. And, you know, she's not permitted the access that, of course, Arabella Figg is somebody who, you know, she's actually more on the wizard side as a squib. But Petunia is just totally on the outs, but she's not unaffected by all the things that are going on there. She is actually, you know, deeply affected. And, of course, these wizard battles affect muggles, too. They just aren't aware all the time that Muggles are being targeted. And I think also one of the things that we can see is that J.K. Rowling, I love that it was the humor episode, you know, that you're drawing on, because we talked a fair amount about the way the Dursleys become the butt of the joke a lot of the time, various mm-hmm. Dursleys do. And that source of humor is, you know, it's pretty mean-spirited.
Your point about Fred and George and what they do to Dudley with the tun tongue toffee, that was, I hadn't thought about it in that way, how you kind of put us in Dudley's perspective, and really Petunia's perspective in terms of what's happening to her son and how terrifying it must have been for the whole family.
You know, funnily enough, when I thought of that, for some reason, I was thinking about that scene. I went, could you imagine if they'd tried to put that in the movies? How revolting and gruesome that scene would be of a teenage boy literally choking on his own purple tongue and his mother, you know, worried about, you know, him suffocating, and Arthur's saying, you know, it's just an engorgement charm, I can fix it. But of course, you know, the Dursleys don't even know what an engorgement charm is, so it's not going to give them any comfort whatsoever. And all Harry says is, oh, this is funny, I think I'd like to hang around and watch. And of course, the boys are roaring with laughter in the burrow, but Mr. Weasley in particular comes home and goes into a rage at the twins like we don't see. And the only other time that we actually hear about it is the time that Ron describes when the twins almost made him do the unbreakable vow, because that was serious stuff, and Arthur goes mental then, and he goes just as mental at the toffee, because, you know, if you think about it this way, if Dudley had snuck that up to his room and eaten it in secret, or 2 minutes after Arthur had left, who knows what might have happened. It's serious stuff, and Arthur really understands, because of his job at the ministry and because he deals with muggle baiting and those sorts of things all the time, he knows that there's a deeper sentiment underneath it that you have to be wary of, because what seems like fun, when you do it to someone who doesn't have any power to respond or to act on that, it can be quite frightening. And I think that's why Arthur just goes completely crook at the twins.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And, you know, there is a sense, I think, by the time we are seeing, I was thinking about, you know, even Dudley getting the pig's tail, which is funny and satisfying, I think, to a lot of kids, readers, you know, because you feel like they deserve it. But then, you know, he has to have that surgically removed. Like, that's not a light thing there. And, you know, I would say Dudley, you know, he's a bit of a victim here as well, a victim of some poor parenting, which Emily, you can tell us some more about.
Oh, yes. Maybe in another episode.
In another episode, right. but that we sort of feel like they deserve it, you know, these muggles. But at the same time, if you have the sense that they also have a history with the magical world in which they have not been treated well or have, you know, felt that they were powerless, then I think that does encourage us to, you know, think about Petunia a little bit differently.
And her having been rejected so firmly from this magical world, you know, I mean, I think that's the part that the reread helps you to understand, is the bitterness of her having been rejected from this world, that she just wanted to follow her sister into this world and explore, you know, this new wondrous thing. And she just wasn't permitted to, because she just doesn't have that power.
And then I think totally you can understand some sour grapes about it, you know, you know, that she's like, well, fine, then that must be terrible. And I don't like all of that anyway. And then
right.
I think that's a large part of her attraction to Vernon, because Vernon is the most muggle person you could possibly end up with. And
oh, what does Emma calls him? The most beige fiance she could get her hands on in the piece. That is just a great way of describing Vernon Dursley. Although there are times that I wish he were a little bit more beige, you know, like he just kind of erupts. He goes more crimson, you know, instead of beige.
Red, green, porridge gray, you know, he's not a rainbow of colors.
But I think really that also a lot of where Petunia ends up, even by the time, like, we start the story where, you know, Harry's already, you know, about to turn 11, what have you. Like, Petunia has shifted in her attitudes partly because of Vernon. She was attracted to him, you know, for the reasons that it was helping her to reject this world that had rejected her. And then there's the little, I think there's a little thrill of, you know, what will he think when he finds out I'm connected, you know, with this magical, this wizarding world. And then they get through that, right? And then she begins to go more to his point of view. And that she is, in a way, she really changes over the course of her relationship with Vernon. I think you see that happens a lot in relationships, you know, that somebody have their own opinions or their own way of thinking about the world changed by the person they're in the relationship with. And I think if you look even at I found two stories on wizardingworld.com, the J.K. Rowling archive, that talk about Petunia. I know there are more, but those are the two I read. And one is Number 4 Privet Drive, and the other one is Petunia and Vernon Dursley. And especially in the second one, J.K. Rowling emphasizes that a lot of what Petunia expresses are really Vernon's ideas and attitudes that she has sort of adopted as her own through that relationship, which I think is interesting too.
Can I have a wild speculative guess as Ooh. To what the breaking point was and what tipped her that way finally?
Love it. I love wild speculative guesses, Emma.
I think the breaking point was that horrendous dumping of Harry on the doorstep. And, you know, it's the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I tell you what, nothing makes a married couple coalesce like mutually hating someone. You know, you've got either those irritating neighbors or, you know, someone. That dumping of Harry was just one of the most insensitive things I've seen anyone do. And shame on you, Dumbledore, because her sister had just died. Her brother-in-law had just died. And as rocky as their relationship was prior to that, they'd still been in correspondence. They'd still made an attempt to, you know, meet James. They'd been invited to each other's weddings, even though it didn't go so well. And we know that Petunia sent Lily a vase for the Christmas right before they were killed by Voldemort, because it's in that letter that Harry finds when he goes back to Grimmauld Place, that horrible vase that Petunia bought. So we know that they had a rocky relationship, but I tell you what, if anything would seal the deal on my hate for the Wizarding World, it would be having some person not even knock and tell me to my face that my sister had died by putting it in the letter of my abandoned nephew's hand and just dumping him on the doorstep. I just think it was... that, if anything, was what drove her to finally just snap and say, no, wizards, never again.
So you made a point in the piece about Petunia sending Lily that vase. And that's a really, you know, it's just one of those lines that you don't even really think much of. But for two women who both have flower names... you know, a vase is kind of an interesting gift. And right. And Lily says it's horrible, but at the same time, it is kind of an olive branch. And it's something that symbolizes their maybe former togetherness. And especially with regard to I wanted to ask you what you think the vase symbolizes. And also if you've done much with their names, the fact that, you know, they have these two names that in, you know, the Victorian love language had real significant meanings, you know, Lily being purity and Petunia being this false Lily, this kind of flower that symbolized bitterness. Like why anybody would make a flower symbolize bitterness, I'm not sure. But, you know, but Petunia, that's what it was in that Victorian symbol system. So talk more about the vase. What do you think that vase really meant? Well, how do we interpret that in retrospect?
I think a vase is very symbolic of holding flowers together. And you've got two sisters who have very clear flower names, and it's designed to keep them alive and hold them together even after they've been cut down. And even though one is a false lily, which you could take to mean maybe Petunia not having any magic and, you know, a real lily per se, but having them together, sharing that same space, sharing the same water that's keeping them both alive, I think is pretty symbolic. And you're right, even though Lily says it's a horrible, horrible object, and she's not too displeased that Harry sort of smashed it, it, you know, tasted different. I defy anyone to stand up and say they've never received a gift from a relative that they haven't just gone, thanks, brown socks, just what I always wanted. We've all had that experience, even from when people have got the best of intentions to do that. But it certainly beats a 50 pence piece or a pair of Vernon's secondhand socks. You know, it was a genuine gift.
Right. A coat hanger.
Yeah, an old coat hanger.
Yeah, definitely in contrast to the things. Yeah, in contrast to the things that Harry gets from Petunia and Vernon, the vase is definitely a different category of gift. And as you said, that does suggest that there is this break that happens once Petunia, you know, she's lost her sister. She now is raising this child who looks just like the boy her sister married from the wizarding world. She has to raise him alongside of her own child, and is not really given any resources with which to do that, but always sort of lingering over is this, you know, this idea that he is a part of this dangerous world, and they're gonna, you know, Vernon's gonna try to squash all the magic out of him if possible, try to just keep him away from that. And, you know, like you say, that represents really a sharp direction change for Petunia as well.
Yes, it's interesting you say no support, because for all that the wizarding world sort of says, we love Harry Potter and they're all fond of him and they love to give him ginger newts when it suits them, where were they for 11, 10 years? A good decade, they all blipped off the map. No support, no physical guarding of the property. You know, Dumbledore explains, hey, you know, there's exceedingly dark wizards under your after your nephew. Go for gold. Nothing but a magic spell over your house. No, remember, James Potter too was sitting on a vault full of gold that he inherited. He never had to work. And yet there's nothing, no advice on how to raise a young wizard, no support whatsoever. And I can't help but feel that it's a certain level of disdain for the Dursleys. I mean, even McGonagall's like, are you sure you want to leave him with them? Dumbledore's like, yeah, they're their own family that, you know, he's got left, so why not? It just seems to be incredibly blasé.
It makes you think, and Dumbledore, you know, obviously we have other evidence for Dumbledore's sort of righteous egotism, as it were, you know, in his confidence in his own magic, right? So he has got a lot of confidence in this, first of all, this blood charm that Lily has cast over her son through her death to save him, but then also through you know, his own ministrations that have set up this protection of dwelling with her blood relatives for Harry, you know, so he does count on that quite totally. You know, and yeah, you're right. All Harry gets of the wizarding world in the first 10 years of his life is, you know, pictures of cats.
Yeah. And
Mrs. Fig again.
Yeah, there she is.
Mrs. Fig.
When's our bonus episode on Mrs. Fig?
Oh, we could do that.
Yeah.
We need some tin cat food and some carpet slippers now. The people demand carpet slippers. But Mrs. Fig, though, she's got the advantage of more insight, I think, into who Dumbledore is and what his capabilities are. I'm sure Petunia doesn't really know that. It's just like, yeah, just trust me. I did a spell. Like, who are you? Do you mind explaining to me why I should trust you?
Yeah. And I think, you know, Arabella Fig, she's got a job to do. And although Petunia also has a job to do, it is one that she doesn't really feel connection to. It's been dropped on her in a way that probably Arabella Fig, I think, probably was able to have some choice in what she was doing. And for Petunia, you know, she does it. She does the job. And I think that's one of the things that you make the point of, too. Like, she actually does the job. She does it in the minimal way, and she does it very grudgingly. But she does take Harry in. And she does keep him at the house. It's very minimal, but she does at least do that much.
She keeps him in a literal way. She keeps him like a zookeeper keeps a animal, but maybe less, you know, less kindly and less nurturing way than a zookeeper would these days.
I wonder if too the, you know, what, because I think about this a lot, you know, that there are things that we are sometimes required to do, and you can do them in a way that is minimal and grudging, you know, and you can, you know, be complaining and grudging about it and really, you know, just do the bare minimum and feel like it's just been pulled from you. Or that thing that you're required to do, you can try to do it fully and with the best attitude that you can and, you know, really even try to find something positive in it. And I think it's this grudging quality of Petunia. And that is a word also that comes into those Wizarding World archive stories that J.K. Rowling has written. That grudging nature of hers is what ultimately, I think, makes her so not good at keeping Harry. She can't fully embrace it somehow, partly because of the way that it's been thrust upon her.
I think it makes her not only not so good at keeping Harry, but it makes her not so good at a lot of things. She lets her grudges get in the way of making decent choices. And mm-hmm. let's face it, Harry was an innocent baby and he was her nephew. Like, come on, woman, give the kid a bedroom, give him a decent feed. Like, how stingy do you have to be when you're clearly doing well enough to give your own child 38 presents every birthday? She let bitterness turn her into a worse person, and that is really where my sympathy for her dries up immediately. However, after the sort of shock of realizing that, hey, maybe people kind of are watching what we do, and there's almost a big brother, almost godlike feeling of being watched in Philosopher's Stone, because, you know, all of a sudden they're getting all these letters and the wizards know exactly where they're going and they can't go to a hotel or a hut in the middle of the sea without receiving those letters. And now that there's a bit of scrutiny on her, the Dursleys after that then actually start to relax their behaviour, and I'll give them a little bit of credit for that. So once you start getting to the later books, particularly after Cedric dies, they don't really interact with him all that much and they pretty much leave him to his own devices. Yeah, okay, it's sort of a not-so-nice silence, but it's certainly better than the mistreatment that we see in the early books.
Yeah, he was like the house elf when we first meet him. You know, he was frying up the breakfast and you know, doing the chores and with very little, you know, living in a cupboard. I mean, he was creature, you know.
Yeah, literally, you know, the little house elf. But after that, you know, we have the incident with Dudley leaving the cold cup of tea outside of his room, and you know, they stop locking him in his room so much in his more senior years, and it sort of just becomes that kind of uneasy getting along as best they can. And I think that all actually changes in Order of the Phoenix. A lot of people, when they like to think about Petunia's redemption, are sort of thinking a little bit too late when they think of Deathly Hallows and where she sort of teeters on the edge of saying something. But I think it comes much earlier than that in the Order of the Phoenix. And there's some really clear understanding that's gained between Harry and his aunt, because his aunt is no longer, you know, trying to keep the Wizarding World at bay. She's now all of a sudden talking about Dementors in her own kitchen.
Yeah, and that's at the beginning of the book, right, with the Dementor attack that and Harry's pulled Dudley away from that. And I think I do think that's a really interesting, important moment for Petunia, at where, as you say, you remember that this is Lily's sister. You know, this is somebody who actually, she does know some things. She doesn't know them very well, and she's been trying to deny them for many years. But she knows them, and so she has some kind of connection to it. And so she can actually relate immediately to Harry on that in a way that was really new.
Yeah, and I think she fully appreciated not only the danger that he was in, because it so suddenly came alive because it touched her own son, but I think she fully appreciated that this is not something that Harry ever wanted or ever brought upon himself. And I think it must have hit her in that moment that, you know, Harry's not inviting this into his life. You know, he's been marked for it. And that little scene that Jo writes, where there's that profound moment of understanding between them, she's so really good at distraction, because she has a whole lot of breakthrough moments right before this paragraph, and then immediately after it we get a classic Uncle Vernon blow up, and you can almost miss it. But there's the moment where he says that Aunt Petunia had never in her life looked at him like that before. Her large pale eyes, so unlike a sister's, were not narrowed in dislike or anger, they were wide and fearful. And he talks about the pretense of the magical world dropping away, but what I think is partially dropping away is the pretense that she has no care for her own nephew.
Yeah, and I think when we're looking at the Dursleys in general, Dudley makes his sort of half-hearted, you're not a total waste of space comment, and Petunia doesn't have fully a moment where she says anything, you know, in the seventh book to Harry that would give us, you know, more of a feeling that of, you know, of a relation. But I think what you're saying there is that, you know, you can really actually see it more when she is feeling under attack with the Dementors. That's when we really see that come through in book five. And maybe she misses the opportunity to do more in seven. But then Vernon Dursley, he never has anything. So there's a little spectrum there from the Dursleys. Vernon remains the muggliest muggle.
For me, I keep coming back to her flower name and the bitterness. And that is a really important moment, Emma, that you named, when she realizes that Voldemort is back. And because she feels the loss of her sister again in that moment, obviously, and she's able to kind of, you know, grief is powerful, and these books tell us that grief is a powerful emotion of love, and you know, especially at the end of book five, you know, we see that Harry's grief really even saves him. It sort of evicts Voldemort from being able to possess him, his grief for Sirius. And so at the beginning, we see this resurgence of grief in Aunt Petunia over the fact that this person who killed her sister, who ultimately took her sister from her, you know, even more so than the magical community did. And we see this resurgence of grief give her this moment of sort of lucidity where her own bitterness can't override, you know, what's in, on her heart, which is, you know, that she loved her sister and that she still grieves her sister. And I think that's a really, but then she snaps back, you know, into her old ways, mostly, you know, not entirely. But I think it's interesting how Rowling paints these two characters as, you know, this one responds to life with purity and this one responds to life with bitterness. And she just sums them up in these flower names that, you know, that kind of encapsulate what they represent in the story. It's just cool stuff.
That's a really good point, because it's really Petunia's bitterness that stops her from connecting with other people. And we know that obviously love is the most important theme and the most powerful thing throughout all those books. But if she wasn't so bitter, if she had maybe reached out to Dumbledore again and asked for help or support, if she'd opened her heart a little bit more to a nephew, if she hadn't been so bitter about what she had missed out on and what she had been denied in her life, maybe she could have made those connections that would have made her life richer. And maybe would have helped her heal from the fact that the sister was taken from her, but, you know, she didn't.
Yeah, and it's striking me now that, you know, do we think that, because in the article I've been working on about parenting, I talk about the totally different ways that the Dursleys parent Dudley versus the way that they parent Harry. It's a totally different parenting kind of type that they follow for each of the boys. And for Dudley, they are extremely indulgent. And I almost wonder if her bitterness at the situation with her sister and having to take on this boy, Harry, doesn't kind of make them more indulgent toward Dudley than they would have been. So you almost kind of see, and then of course Dumbledore points out the damage that they've done to him in book six, in indulging him throughout his life, and the harm that's done to him. And so you kind of almost wonder if her bitterness isn't the cause of harm to even her son, even ironically through indulgence.
I would agree with that 100%. As you said, Dumbledore comments on the damage that it's done to him, and there's always that everlasting question of what on earth did Dudley see when the Dementors got him? You know, what damage was that kid carrying around? You know, he had to have been damaged in some way to have a reaction like that.
So actually, I was really interested thinking about how we actually get introduced to Petunia really early on in the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone. And, you know, because we're really introduced to the, you know, the household there. And the thing that's really the most, I guess, outstanding characteristic of Petunia at this point is her long neck that is described as coming in very useful, as she spent so much of her time craning over garden fences, spying on the neighbors. And this strikes me as, you know, a person who, and the long neck of the petunia, right, her stem, as she is peering into the lives of others and, you know, feeling some resentments of her own. And then that creates actually a really toxic way of relating to the things that she even has for herself. And so I think we're given a really interesting insight into her right off the bat. It's one of those things, once again, that shows that J.K. Rowling has her characters. She knows her characters from the very first pages. And to be able to then see that drawn out in a very humanistic way, Petunia starts out cartoonish and then I think becomes, you know, I think a person that we can imagine being a real person, a fully drawn character.
And when we think of, you know, characters in the real world and we think about real families, we know that, you know, even in our own lives, we can find getting along with our family difficult. We can find loving difficult. And we know, you know, love is easy to give when times are easy. You know, when things are all happy, it is great. But when things are difficult, that's when loving people is tough. But that is also when it's at its most powerful, I think. And any love that Petunia ever felt for Harry in any small amount, I think it would have been difficult for her to give. But I think, you know, it would have had great power.
Wow, that's a perfect note to end on. Yes. Thank you so much, Emma Nicholson, for helping us to explore this multidimensional character from the series. Petunia.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. You know, I've been obviously a long time listener every single episode. it's been great. And it's been an honor to work with you guys as well. It's always so much fun to get the new episodes ready for cutting. I always really enjoy it. And, you know, thank you to everyone who listens. And I hope that our listeners do know how much love and not much else powers this particular podcast. There's an awful lot of love and a lot of great people behind it. And apart from a little bit of speller tape and Skyping and emails, there's really not much else that keeps it going. So, you know, particularly you, Katie, Em and John, it's been fantastic.
Well, thank you so much, Emma. And,
I agree.
You know, we could not do it without you and the labor of love that this represents for you as well. Just amazing. And I do think this is a product of, you know, all of our ties to the book series and the ideas in the books, but also that creates community in itself. And I have just really valued getting to know you more, Emma.
And thanks for your extra work as we prepare these bonus episodes, Emma. I know it's more work for you, so
yes,
thanks
very
for
much
that.
So.
Not a problem at all. You know, we're all in ISO. What else have we got to do?
That's
we're
right.
We're all in this together.
That's right.
Well, thanks also to you, Emily, for being my co-host on the podcast today.
Always a good time. Thanks for having me.
As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. And our MuggleNet producer, Lori Beckoff. Thanks, Lori. Dear listeners, we are also so glad that you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or a question for us, especially if you have an idea for one of these shorter episodes. We'd love to hear it. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. I am mixing up our closing quote just a bit, given the unusual crisis we're collectively experiencing due to COVID-19. And so now I'll leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Happiness can be found even in the darkest of times, if one only remembers to turn on the light." Please join us next time when we'll be turning on the light with the help of a little Harry Potter magic.